Dear, very dear audience, well, I'm very much moved that so many of you have come together. So I'm always at the margin of losing my ability to speak, but not completely. First, there are different things happening here. The previous speakers spoke English language, but now I'm going to speak in Hungarian. Until now, you had presentations about the way in which Europe goes. I'm going to speak about Hungary, a very specific question in connection with Hungary, and that is taxation. Until now, you have been celebrating some old people, me. You were celebrating me, but my presentation is meant to honor one of our great predecessors, István Széchenyi. Perhaps it's surprising, but it's very important for us to keep our own past, and it's important to remind ourselves to where we have been in the past and where we have got to. So the first question is, why taxation? I don't know whether I cause any trouble for the interpreters, because I have my slides in two languages. So one part is in Hungarian and the other part is in English. I'm trying to be as brief as possible. So the first question is why I have chosen taxation as a specific example of what happens between Hungary and Europe. But taxation is a very important matter. It is much, much more important than we believe it to be in public parlance. So if Europe wants to keep the European model and wants to keep its spirit, taxation is necessary. Taxation is different from country to country. That is clear. They started from different situations. They had different taxes. In Western Europe, they have got to a stage that there was something in common as a feature that was called welfare state, which means that also the funds had to be collected somehow, and as a result of that, there was an agreement Hungary was party to or was not party to after the year of 2000. The taxation is a very good example by which you can follow to what extent countries in the EU converge to one another and to what an extent they are diverging. For Hungary, there was a very difficult pass in terms of the distance between this country and the European Union, but it was hard for us to proceed. When the Golden Bull declared the exemption of the nobility in 1222, it was not a big miracle. In England, there has never been a tax exemption of the nobility. I don't know whether I'm right or wrong, but this tax exemption was never so clear, and it was often disputed. When Martinovich and his followers were beheaded later, they before that, of course, had argued a lot about it. In fact, there is a beautiful sentence saying that taxation of the mobility under any legal title shall in no way become a subject of national debate. I'm going to speak about some of the debates that followed, but one of the major achievements of Hungarian liberalism was to abolish tax exemption for the nobility in 1848. I'm addressing to the foreign participants of the conference when I'm saying who Széchenyi was, because Széchenyi is a fairly well-known person in Hungary. But as far as I understand, we have not seen so many people throughout our history who had such a powerful impact on the life of the country, even after 100 years. So when foreigners come to Budapest, they see the chain bridge, the suspension bridge, the Academy of Sciences, the bridges, the roads, and they were all started, launched by István Széchenyi, so the steamboat on the river Danube, and navigation on the river Danube, and some other very important initiatives are all associated with his name. So I was, in fact, surprised to get to know that some of the foreigners didn't hear about it, but Széchenyi went to the Iron Gate on horseback. He visited the Turkish Sultan, and he learned a lot, discussed a lot with them, and introduced a lot of new things in Hungary. He wrote a lot of books about credit and other financial matters, and he was an extremely creative man, human mind, and if I got to know him by his works, I would like to share some information about him with you.
So when did it all begin? It began way before the rebel led by Martinovich, and was kept up until around 1820-30. But one of the topics, the main topics, was about the abolition of tax exemption privileges of nobility. Széchenyi had two problems. One was his private life. He wrote thousands of pages. There's no day of his life that did not is not recorded in his journal. And he wrote about 2-3 dozens of letters, which are all kept. And then the public life, which also runs to thousands of pages of works. Now, liberalism was quite silent. It was only nobility that wrote letters to each other. Everything was hush-hush. Széchenyi started writing his journal around 1820, and he became a leading figure of the fight against the privileges of the nobility in terms of tax exemption. I think this is highly topical. This is why I evoked this. And secondly, because I really like his works. The topical nature, of course, speaks for itself. We have Széchenyi card, we have Széchenyi square, we have institutions named after Széchenyi. And it would be interesting to know what he himself would have thought about it. What about the successes that you can see? He thought this. This goes back to 1844, but it could have come back earlier. We Hungarians today are not only not leading the way in anything, but we are not even in the middle ranks either. Rather, we rank at the very end of the line of peoples that wish to belong to the civilized world. My colleagues know that we had a survey graphs of 27, 28 countries, and Hungary lags around the 27th, 28th place in terms of every indicator, inequality, poverty, and the rest. So these almost 200-year-old words are really highly timely even today. Now, the central issue initially in terms of economy for Széchenyi was credit. But he soon realized that it's not about credit, it's about taxes. And he realized more about taxes than we can even think today. There's just one exception that I found when I was browsing the web. I found a taxation plan which includes pretty much everything that I can conceive of in a taxation plan. It's very interesting. All the other tax plans are not so socially indicated. Széchenyi knew that taxation was a great social uniting, cohesive power. And he said that there is no nation in the world that couldn't have made its way, that could have made its way to the rank of civilized free nations without this cohesive power. Now, civilization and being civilized was something very important for Széchenyi. And he said many times that public intellectuals, public intellect, and civilization are cardinal values for the nation. Now, the historical basic component was the 100-year-old, in fact, several hundred-year-old debate about whether laws can be changed, and specifically the cardinal laws, or not. There were those who attacked taxation, and there were those who protected tax, non-payment of tax. Of course, Széchenyi was utterly familiar with the debate, and he sums it up in an entry of his journal, saying, "What do the two parties actually aim at and want, the party attacking and the one protecting the tax exemption of the nobility?" And he says the attacking party wants the Hungarian nobility to pay taxes and share all other burdens equally with the peasants, because up until then it was only the peasants, the poor, that shared all the burdens. The protecting party does not want to pay anything and does not want to give anything and does not want to do any duty. Now, this 200-year-old or multi-hundred-year-old debate was condensed in these few lines in Széchenyi's journal. The specific taxation debate was studied by a dream of Széchenyi, and that was the bridge, the first permanent bridge across the Danube connecting Buda and Pest. And of course, as it went in those days, everybody was supposed to pay a toll to cross the bridge. But there were some exemptions. For example, government officials weren't supposed to be paying. And then 15 years elapsed, and the bridge was still not there, not even the construction started. And the debate was rampant whether everybody should be paying the toll or not. And here again, there's this beautiful quotation from the journal. A gentleman, a rather enlightened one compared to others, has recently told me, "I'd rather wait for 3 days in Pest or travel to Buda in a boat by breaking the ice on the river than pay a toll on the bridge, even if it was made of shiny steel." And this just shows how well constructed the bridge ultimately was. So here again, we don't have the triple pyramid, but it's rather when the issue of taxation comes back in the late 1940s, and he's more specific about the amount that Hungary would be able to bear and how much should be distributed and levied and collected. In the specific issues is the so-called 2 deniers per acre, not per acre, in fact, 2.5 acres. And the thought comes up here that this is just the biggest generalization. And here there are long quotations which I couldn't possibly incorporate in the slides. What constitutes bad field and good field, productive field and non-productive field. He says the 2 deniers per 2.5 acres should be understood in the most general terms, meaning that, for instance, wheat fields lying in the vicinity of good markets should be levied a tax of 4 or even 6 deniers. While in the case of surf plots, 1 denier per 2.5 acres or less should be imposed. So he says this, and there's also something that I did not include in my slides, but also it's also something that Széchenyi said in general, or for the sake of symbols, even the poorest should pay just a tiny, tiny nominal tax in order to indicate the cohesion, the cohesive force of taxation. And I think this is a very important idea. Yes, there should be taxation, and there should be low tax rates, but everybody should pay some tax, even if this some tax is very low, because it holds society together. And I think it's a very clever idea. Unfortunately, since Adam Smith, there's this core idea in the taxation system that is living wage, and I'm not going to go into what actually minimum wage means in Hungary and how it's calculated. Everybody should pay even at the minimum wage, and maybe I will return that tax paid, maybe not. Széchenyi says the same, maybe even in a nicer way than Smith, because Adam Smith only alludes to the fact that it should be perhaps returned. This is topical in England, where leather shoes are quite an issue now. Széchenyi says, maybe in a nicer way, I'm far from demanding that anybody in this white country of ours should be cold or hungry or should suffer such kind of bodily damage for the sake of maintaining and improving our nation due to taxation. Now, time flew by, and I think the basic ideals that I have enumerated, and I could add a few more, are very nicely laid down as the foundation of a fair taxation system. And then, of course, time went on and came the 20th century and World War II. And after World War II, essentially, we've had more or less peace and managed to find out what sort of state should emerge. The traditional functions of the state, of course, remained: administration, order, defense, etc. And then, from the 30s and much more rapidly after the Second World War, a lot of changes occurred, which gave rise to a more or less public consensus, not a full consensus, but some kind of a consensus about why the state should levy taxes. Of course, there's never public consensus. Liberals in masses negate the principle, but in liberal-minded Europe, still, taxation has gained a majority, and this is still the basis of the social model that this conference is supposed to be about. So there is a relative consensus with the participation of the electorate that we need welfare systems which satisfies needs at an adequate level. The Central Statistics Office of Hungary has considered that maybe the daily caloric need of Hungarians is too high, and they lower it by almost half, and this gives rise to a whole host of new statistics. I think in that case, if this is the case, the Central Statistics Office's statisticians failed to read Smith and have no idea about what satisfying needs at an adequate level actually means, because reducing calorie is not adequate. If reduction of inequalities fails, then there'll be no integrated social integration, and there'll be no justice. There's also some sort of a consensus about investment into the future, etc., into sustainability, protection against risks vis-à-vis sustainability, etc. Now, it's an interesting question to see that taxes are used for a variety of purposes. For example, if you give to a poor to if you give to if you donate money for good causes, then you can deduct it from your taxes. Also, if you upgrade your doors and windows, you can deduct it from your taxes, etc. So there are a variety of tax allowances, and they are entirely contrary to what the rest of Europe regards as the basis for a tax allowance or tax reduction. Now, progressive tax system also has a more or less functioning element of economic stabilization. The taxation system is actually an economic stabilizer that is ensured by taxation. Now, here again, we would need about an hour and a half for this table and the next one that I'm going to show. I just tried to, I hope you can hear what I'm saying. Yeah, okay. I tried to capture the, based on the tax reports of various European countries, I tried to capture whether or not Hungary approaches Europe and how this can be illustrated in terms of figures. What happens in the West, what happens in the East, and what happens in Hungary around 2030. The simplest point of figure is the number of countries where state incomes are bigger than 40% of the GDP. State budget exceeds 40% of the GDP. Despite all details, these figures are pretty much the same, or have been the same, pretty much the same for the past 20 years. More in 9 of the 28 European Union member states, there's over 40%. In none of the Eastern European countries is this the case, and that includes Hungary. Now, what about progressive personal income tax? 17 countries in the West cannot imagine, in the older member states cannot imagine progressive PIT. Now, this started in the East because the Eastern countries could conceive of a progressive income tax system. The Baltic states were the first. And some state joins, for example, Slovakia. And Hungary, as usual, considered the progressive personal income system when the others already abandoned it. So all in all, only 4 of the 11 newly acceded countries have progressive personal income taxing system. And Slovenia and Poland have reversed. Poland is a special issue, but it is considering to conceive a different system. Now, what about tax brackets? Some say that it's not bad not to have too many, but on the whole, Hungary is the only country within the European Union where there is a single tax bracket. In 16 out of the 17 old member states, there is more than 3 tax brackets, and in Ireland, there's a whole host. Monaco is the difference. Is the only difference where there's no taxation. Taxes come from the casinos, so they don't need to levy any taxes. But then Monaco is not an EU member state. And then the top personal income tax rate is the next line. In fact, the number of tax brackets is about taxes per se, but to what extent a poor taxpayer is apparent, is conspicuous in the Eastern culture and the Western culture is very, very revealing. I was shocked to see that out of the 17 countries, Greece is the only one where today there's no basic allowance. The first rate, which is tax-free, the first bracket that is tax-free. And in the Eastern countries, of course, again, they have a basic a basic tax rate or tax bracket that is not taxed. And of course, you may guess that Hungary is the one where there's no such a phenomenon. Also, the top VAT rate. But before coming to that, of course, tax reduction in Hungary is a very interesting system because it's based on the number of children. The fewer children, the greater the advantage. But if you have more than three children, you don't have any more allowance compared to three children. I also try to have a look at the rate of the VAT and the personal income tax. In the Nordic countries, people pay twice as much personal income tax than VAT. In Hungary, of course, VAT is considerably higher than the personal income tax. But not to forget that not only in Europe but worldwide, Hungary is the country where the VAT rate is the absolute highest. And there's absolutely no plan on the part of the government to reduce the VAT rate. I have these tables in English as well as in Hungarian about the implementation of state objectives after 2010, how the objectives, the goals of the states have been implemented or not, that should be implemented or should have been implemented through taxation. And let me now here say a few words about something that is typical, but it's not, strictly speaking, the topic of this presentation only in a tangential way. Not only have the democratic frameworks been preserved in Europe, but there's a very persistent effort at decentralization. There's a very persistent effort to strengthen local communities and to strengthen civil society. We can ask, I can ask my English-speaking friends or my British friends whether I see this correctly or not. This change in the nature of the state that actually stems from the United States, whether or not the state should be punitive or not. Some countries move towards a more punitive state, and this is something that is very strongly the case in Hungary. Conversely, Hungary made an about face as regards decentralization. There's a very strong effort at centralization in every area, in every walk of life. I don't want to dwell upon this because we all know how it happens that the state takes over the services and the school system, or some services are only handed over to the churches. It's also strange that we tend to say to belong to a Christian Europe, whereas I see an upheaval among scholars in England, I think, and scientists who say don't subordinate the state to any religion. And I'm coming to the end of my presentation. So about the welfare functions of the states, well, Hungary is the only European country where even the living wage is taxed. Hungary is the only country that is exception in some respects. I hear a lot that tax allowances are dangerous, but in Hungary, various tax rebates or tax allowances have been done away with. For example, allowance for commuting, etc. The only one that is left is allowance on account of children. But where this still prevails, it's regressive. So it starts at a rather high level, and we are doing it exactly, and is gradually reduced, and we are doing it exactly the other way around then, compared to other states. Now, if we look at convergence, I think we can safely say, in conclusion, that Hungary is an exception. It's an exception in many respects, and I'm not going to repeat the famous utterances by the Prime Minister, but I think it's specifically dangerous. Thank you for turning off the buzz. But I think it's equally dangerous for the European Union in several respects. We see that it's contagious. We see that it attracted Poland. Southern countries were attracted. And we're even encouraging them, because the EU is not even frowning upon it. What Hungary seems to profess is that there is a need for anti-Semitism, there is a need for racism against the Roma, and it seems that part of Europe is receptive to it, and this is dangerous. If the EU wants to stay together and wants convergence to prevail, then this is a dangerous state of affairs. Now, in conclusion, again, say Cheney. This is from his writings not long before he committed suicide and appeared a long, long time after his death. And I read it out. Transforming the disharmony between peoples and their governments into harmony is always difficult, even if both leaders and those being led have a clear vision to the greatest possible extent. However, if the peoples are stricken by short-sightedness and those in power are downright blind, then the creation of harmony is somewhat beyond human strength. And at such times, things rest upon luck, the world spirit, a superior light, fate, or God. Thank you very much for your attention.